Dear God, our Heavenly Father, we come before you now very thankful for the opportunity to come before you and worship you on this your Sabbath day. Thank you for this opportunity that you give us to learn more of your word and lessons from it. We pray for your inspiration upon this Bible study today and also your guidance and protection and direction as we go home this evening. So thank you for your word of truth. We ask for your inspiration now and ask all of this by the name and authority of Jesus Christ. Amen. Okay, we're going to be covering Numbers 22 through 24 today, but as we always do, let's do a short review, a quick review of what we covered the last time. In the last Bible study, we covered chapters 20 and 21 of the book of Numbers, and in chapter 20, we found that Israel had come to the 40th year of their wandering. You know, they were judged by God to wander 40 years in the desert, and those that had were 20 years of age and older, were to die in the desert. Now they had come to the 40th year. In that 40th year, here described in chapter 20, Miriam dies, and as well as those who are 20 years and older at the Exodus. They had all died. In chapter 20, it is stated that there was no water when they had come to a certain place, and Moses struck the rock, and because he did not do according to God's instructions, by speaking to the rock, he actually struck it twice. He was told he would not be able to go into the promised land. Also in chapter 20, Israel asks permission to pass through Edom, but the king of Edom denied their passage through there. There's a highway called the King's Highway, which was a better route to the land of Canaan, but Edom would not allow them to go through there. Then finally, at the end of chapter 20, Aaron dies, and his son Eleazar is made high priest. Looking at chapter 21 briefly, at the beginning of chapter 21, there was a Canaanite king of the southern part of Canaan, of the kingdom of Arad. He feared Israel tremendously. So he came and attacked Israel, and instead of defeat, God allowed victory over the Canaanite kingdom of Arad. But because Israel had more lessons to learn, Israel went south and east of the land of Edom in the hot, dry desert. While they were in the desert, they began to complain of no water, and because of that, God sent fiery serpents among them. They had to make a journey. Now, the next 2 points in chapter 21, the last 2 points here on the screen, actually sets us up for chapter 22. They journey around Moab, and also Israel conquers Sihon and Og, who were Amorite kingdoms. That's explained in Numbers chapter 21, verses 30, 23 and 24, where it says, "But Sihon would not allow Israel to pass through his territory." Remember that in chapter 20, Moses sent messengers to ask Edom for passage, and they were denied. He also sent messengers to Sihon, and he would not allow Israel to pass through his territory. But here, as we continue on reading, "So Sihon gathered all his people together and went out against Israel in the wilderness. And he came to Jahaz and fought against Israel. Then Israel defeated him with the edge of the sword, took possession of his land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, as far as the people of Ammon." And it was quite a bit of territory that they ended up possessing because of this victory. And that sets us up for what's going to happen in chapter 22. Chapter 22 begins the last stage of the journey towards the promised land. They're on the plains of Moab, and on the east side of the Jordan River, ready to go into the promised land. Now, the rest of the book of Numbers and the book of Deuteronomy is going to take place on the plains of Moab, just shy of the promised land. Verse number 1. "Now the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan River across from Jericho. So they are on the very verge of going into the promised land. Israel camps on the east side of the Jordan River on the verge of going into the land of Canaan, but they're not going to go in yet. Verse number 2. Now Balak, who was the king of Moab, Balak, the son of Zippor, saw that Israel, what he had done to the Amorites. And Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people, because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. Now, what we had saw in chapter 21, the defeat of Sihon, scared the king of Moab. And he was fearful that he was next, that Israel is going to war against them and take their land. And that's what he's scared of. Balak was a Baal worshiping king of Moab. He had previously been defeated by Sihon, king of the Amorites, and lost territory to him. And so now Balak sees the defeat of Sihon by Israel, and he fears Israel with dread. Now let me just explain something before we go on here now. Balak is the king of Moab. Moab was descendants of Lot. Remember Abraham's nephew Lot? Moab was descendants of Lot, from Lot's older daughter. So the Moabites were related to Israel, and yet they are fearing them with dread. I've got a map here now to explain these things. We saw in verse number 1 that Israel camped in the plains of Moab on the side of Jordan across from Jericho. Okay, let me get here in position. The Jericho River runs north and south like this from the Dead Sea. Over here on the west side of the Jordan River is the land of Canaan, the promised land. Israel is in the plains of Moab on the east side of the Jordan River. And that's where they're at right now. Now Moab is down here. And again, they are relatives of the Israelites. Their territory goes from this river down here up to this area right in here and all this territory. Okay, so Moab is right there, and we talked about this in the last Bible study. Israel actually went around Edom and around Moab, because God told them to avoid both of those kingdoms, because they were relatives. You don't see it in the book of Numbers, but it's actually in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 2, and verse number 9, where God told Israel to avoid Moab, and do not meddle with them, do not come to battle against them. Okay, so let's continue on now. Verse number 4. So Moab said to the elders of Midian. Midian was scattered within this territory, the Midianites. So Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now this company," talking about Israel, "will lick up everything around us, as an ox licks up the grass of the field." An ox in the ancient time was a symbol of power and strength. And Moab is saying that they're very, very powerful, and they're going to defeat us. So Balak here advises Midian, who is apparently allied with Moab, of the danger of Israel's power. And again, an ox was a symbol of strength and power in the ancient world. Continuing on, and Balak, the son of Zippor, was the king of the Moabites at that time. Verse number 5. Now he feels desperate here because he fears Israel. Verse 5. Then he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people. The river here is, didn't bring that up on the screen, sorry. Then he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people. The river here that he sent messengers to was the Euphrates River in the land of Babylonia, 300 miles away from where they're at. To call him saying, "Look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me." Now, I'm reading in the New King James. It says, "They are settling next to me." If you're reading in the Old King James, the word is they abide next to me. And when you go back to the Hebrew, what he was referring to is they're ready for war. At any time, they're going to be attacking us. Now, Balaam, here in verse number 5, means destroyer of the people. And Pethor was a city on the Euphrates River in Mesopotamia, Babylonia, which is referred to as the river here. Expositors has an interesting comment here. It says, since Balak believed there was no military means available to withstand the forces of Israel, he sought to battle Israel on the level of pagan divination. So he doesn't feel like he can go against them with physical forces, so he's going to turn to a pagan diviner. Verse number 6, so he sends these messengers, and this is what they say, therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of this land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. So he sent for this pagan prophet to curse Israel, to try to defeat them. And Balaam was a prophet who pronounced blessings and cursings, a pagan prophet. And in the ancient world, words pronounced by such prophets were viewed as weapons like arrows or stones, as good as military forces by their words, in other words, by their cursings. Verse number 7. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the diviner's fee in their hand. They're going to pay Balaam to come and curse Israel. And they came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak. And again, they had to go 300 miles to fetch Balaam to come curse Israel. All right, here's an interesting comment from expositors. Balaam was an internationally known prophet, a diviner expert in examining the entrails of animals and observing natural phenomena to determine the wills of the gods. Remember we talked about in Leviticus that in the pagan world, they would look at the livers and the various parts of the animals to determine the God's will, the pagan God's will, etc. They would also look at the stars, they'd look at the movement of animals to try to determine the will of the gods. Expositors adds this, the recovery of prophetic texts of Balaam in Aramaic from the 6th century at Deir Allah in Jordan shows how very famous this man was in the ancient Near East. In other words, there's tablets discovered of his actual existence of this prophet Balaam. Okay, now this word diviner, because that's what he was a diviner. Here's a comment from the Aid to Bible Understanding talking about what a diviner did. The birthplace of divination was Babylonia, which I don't think that's any surprise. Looking into the liver in quest of omens was based on the belief that all vitality, emotion, and affection were centered in this organ. They thought a lot of the liver. The variations in its lobes, ducts, appendages, veins, ridges, and markings were interpreted as signs or omens from the gods. A large number of clay models of livers have been found, the oldest from Babylonia, containing omens and texts in cuneiform used by diviners. Ancient Assyrian priests were called Baru, meaning inspector. He who sees, because of the prominence of liver inspecting, played in their fortune-telling religion. So they would look at the liver to try to determine the will of the gods. Now that's described in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 21, verse 21 and 22, talking about the king of Babylon making a decision. And notice this, verse 21, for the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the road, at the fork of the two roads, to use divination. He shakes the arrows, he consults the images, he looks at the liver. So here's a scripture in Ezekiel talking about the king of Babylon trying to decide which road to take. And he uses these consults the images and he looks at the liver to try to determine what the gods will have him do. And that's what they did in the ancient world, and that's what Balaam did. Okay, verse number 8, continuing on. And he said to them, Balaam said to the messengers, he said to them, lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you, notice this, as the Lord speaks to me. So the princes of Moab stayed with him. Notice, he says, as the Lord speaks to me. Balaam said to the elders of Midian, as the Lord speaks to me, he speaks as though he is intimate with God, like he has some kind of relationship with God. Continuing on then, notice verse number 9. We have a change in the wording here. Then God said to Balaam, who are these men with you? Okay, Balaam had used the name Lord, which was Yahweh, which is the name of Israel's relationship with God. The Lord, our English word Lord, which is Yahweh, describes the intimate relationship that God had with Israel. And Balaam is using that name, Lord, like he has a relationship with God. But notice in verse number 9, God, which is Elohim, the plural, the creator of everything, came to Balaam and said. So it's a way of saying here in the scriptures that no, he didn't have a relationship. God did not have a relationship with Balaam at all. Verse number 10. So Balaam said to God, Balak, the king of Moab, has sent to me saying, look, a people has come out of Egypt and they cover the face of the earth because there were so many of them. Come now, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to overpower them and drive them out. So Balak feared Israel and he pressed Balaam to have Israel cursed. Okay, continuing on now, verse number 12. And God, notice the word God, Elohim, is used again because there is no relationship between him and Balaam. God said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. So God says, no, I want to mention something here before we go on too, that Balaam probably saw a night vision from God, and he's not to accompany the elders to Moab, and that Israel is a blessed people by him, and that he was not to curse them. Verse number 13. So Balaam rose in the morning, said to the princes of Balak, go back to your land, for the Lord has refused to give me permission to go with you. Still, he's claiming that he has a relationship with God, but he realizes God says, no, I can't go with you and curse the people. Verse 14, and the princes of Moab rose and went back to Balak, 300 miles back to Moab, and said, Balaam refuses to come with us. Verse 15, then Balak sent princes more numerous and more honorable than they. He sent other princes with more money this time to pay Balaam. Again, they had to make a long trip. Verse 16, and they came to Balaam and said to him, thus says Balak, please let nothing hinder you from coming to me. Verse 17, for I will honor you greatly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Therefore, please come and curse this people for me. So another group of princes tried to persuade Balaam to come, and they are offering what we would call a blank check. Whatever you want, we'll give it to you. Just come and curse these people. Verse number 18. Then Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. So again, he's still claiming that he has some relationship with God, but he realizes that he can't go beyond what God tells him to do. He says here at verse number 18, the Lord my God. Here's a statement from expositors. It says, it seems best to take Balaam's words as examples of braggadocio. Balaam is universally condemned in the scripture for moral, ethical, and religious faults. You know, you can look at Jude 11 and Revelation chapter 2, verse 14, talking about Balaam. Okay, continuing on, verse number 19. Now therefore, please, you also stay here tonight, that I may know more what the Lord will say to me. And God, verse 20, came to Balaam at night and said to him, here's some specific instructions from God to Balaam. If the men come to call you, rise and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do. So God said to Balaam, this pagan diviner, okay, you can go with these men, but you're only going to say what I tell you to say. So verse 21, then Balaam rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. And apparently he was determined, even though God told him, you know, that not to curse Israel, apparently he was still determined to curse them. Because we're going to see that God gets angry with him. Verse number 22. Then God's anger was aroused because he went. And again, probably because he was determined now to curse Israel, even though God said not to. God's anger was aroused because he went. And the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. And he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. Okay, the angel of the Lord here, and I've got it in bold letters, that's the Hebrew Malak, which is the messenger, who is the one who would become Jesus Christ. He's the one that is standing in the way of Balaam here, who's riding on his donkey. Now notice verse 23. Now the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. So Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back on the road. Okay, now the donkey could see the angel of the Lord, while Balaam, who was supposed to be this one who could look into animals and see the movement of animals and define how the gods told him to move, he didn't see the angel of the Lord here. He's supposed to be able to communicate with the gods through animals, and he could not. But as we see the last part of verse 23, Balaam strikes the donkey. This is the first time. Verse 24. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards, with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. Verse 25. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pushed herself against the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall. So he struck her again. Again, here we see an animal who can see the angel of the Lord. Of course, this is God's work doing that. But Balaam, who's this supposed prophet, he can't see him. But he strikes the animal again the second time. Verse 26, then the angel of the Lord went further, stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. Verse 27, and when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam, got down on the ground. So Balaam's anger was aroused, and he struck the donkey with his staff. The third time, he strikes this poor animal, and he doesn't even know what's going on. Verse 28, notice this. Then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey. This is God's work now. It isn't that the animal has ability to speak. God made it so the animal could talk. So here again, here we have this pagan prophet who's supposed to be able to read animals and everything. He doesn't know what's going on. Now the animal speaks. So the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey and said to Balaam, what have I done to you that you have struck me these three times? And Balaam said to the donkey, conversation, Balaam said to the donkey, because you have abused me. I wish there was a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you. Verse 30, so the donkey said to Balaam, am I not your donkey on which you have ridden ever since I became yours to this day? Was I ever disposed to do this to you? And he said no. So again, this is God's work of the animal talking and telling him, why are you abusing me? You have no reason to do that. Here's an interesting comment from expositors. It says, "Then the donkey spoke." Some have imagined too much here. The donkey did not give a prophetic oracle. She merely said what a mistreated animal might say to an abusive master if given the chance. There was no preaching from the donkey. Others have stumbled at the improbability of an animal speaking, for such is the stuff of fairy tales. What keeps this story from the genre of legend or fairy tale is the clear factor that the animal did not speak of its own accord, but was given the power to do so by the Lord. I thought that was an interesting comment. Verse 31. Then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes. So finally Balaam starts to see something. And this is God's work again, opening Balaam's eyes. And he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed his head and fell flat on his face. Must have been an awesome sight that this Balaam gets down and falls on his face before the angel of the Lord. Verse 32, "And the angel of the Lord said to him, 'Why have you struck your donkey these three times?'" Which is what the donkey had asked him. "Behold, I have come out to stand against you, because your way is perverse before me." Verse 33, "The donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely I would have killed you by now and let her live." So God is teaching Balaam a lesson here. Here's another good comment from expositors. The word, "Then the Lord opened Balaam's eyes," follows the same structure in verse 28, that "Then the Lord opened the donkey's mouth." In some ways, the opening of the eyes of the pagan prophet to see the reality of the living God was the greater miracle. The animal was a brute beast. The prophet was a man bent on trafficking with idolatrous gods. Okay, continuing on, verse 34. "Then Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, 'I have sinned,'" which he wasn't truly repenting. He just realized this was a powerful being and he needs to say this. "I have sinned, for I did not know you stood in the way against me. Now therefore, if it displeases you, I will turn back." You know, I'll go back home. Verse 36. No, excuse me, verse 35. "Then the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, 'Go with these men, but only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak.' So Balaam went with the princes of Balak." So God finally says, okay, you can go with the messengers back to Balak in Moab, but you're only going to say what I tell you to say. Verse 36. "Now when Balak heard that Balaam was coming, he went out to meet him at the city of Moab, which is on the border of the Arnon, the boundary of the territory." He's all excited. He's probably rejoicing. Okay, he's going to come and curse Israel and they'll finally be defeated. Verse 37. "Then Balak said to Balaam, 'Did I not earnestly send to you calling for you? Why did you not come to me? Am I not able to honor you?'" In other words, he was saying, why did you drag your feet? "Didn't I call you a long time ago? And I'll take care of you. I'll give you everything you want." Okay, got another comment from expositors here, where it says, "Only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak." This is the point of the whole chapter. Balaam, the pagan mantic, will not be able to speak cursing as he had planned. God's not going to allow him to curse Israel. Verse 38. "And Balaam said to Balak, 'Look, I have come to you. Now have I any power at all to say anything? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I must speak.'" So Balaam confesses to Balak, "Look, I know you sent for me and I'm here, but I can only say what God tells me to say." Verse 39. "So Balaam went with Balak and they came to Kirjath Huzoth." Now notice this. They're going to try to conjure up the pagan gods here. Verse 40. "Then Balak offered oxen and sheep, and he sent some to Balaam and to the princes who were with him." So they're offering in sacrifices, oxen and sheep. What is this sum that they send? The offering oxen and sheep are not sacrifices to God, but to pagan idols or their gods. The sending sum included the livers, which would be used for divination. That's what they send now. Verse 41. So it was the next day that Balak took Balaam, brought him up to the high places of Baal, that from there he might observe the extent of the people. That's what I just read, I'm sorry. The high places of Baal, now, this is called Bamoth Baal, was a cultic center dedicated to Baal, the pagan god, and a place supposedly imbued with spiritual power. Okay, that takes us to the end of chapter 22. Now we come to chapter 23. They're trying to conjure up the pagan gods here now is what they're doing. Verse number 1 of chapter 23. Then Balaam said to Balak, build 7 altars for me here and prepare for me 7 bulls and 7 rams. And Balak did just as Balaam had spoken, and Balak and Balaam offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Okay, now, we need to point out, and as a Bible knowledge commentary does, there's no biblical instruction or precedent for what Balaam did. So, what they did here with the 7 bulls and the 7 rams and the 7 altars was part of a pagan ritual. Now, what's interesting here is the number 7. We know that 7 is an important number in God's scheme. It means completeness. God created the creation week was involved in 7 days. He rested on the 7th day. The 7th trumpet, the Feast of Trumpets. There's so much that we could talk about the importance of the number 7. Here what we have is a combining of something that is important in worshiping God, combining it with worship of pagan gods. And that's what false religion has done throughout the ages. Combining true things with false things. Okay. Verse number 3. Then Balaam said to Balak, stand by your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. So he went to a desolate height. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, this is an example of false religion copying or counterfeiting elements of true worship in a superstitious way, with the number 7. Expositors adds this, the number 7 was held in high regard among the Semitic peoples in general. The many animals would provide an abundant liver and organ materials for the diviner from the east. So they thought, get a good quantity of animals, we'll have a number of livers, and we'll be able to seek the Lord's advice here. And it says here in verse number 3, stand by your offering, which was representing the people of Moab in a pagan priestly function. Okay, now, after making his sacrifices, the pagan sacrifices, Balaam seeks a revelation from God. Verse number 4, God met Balaam and said to him, and he said to him, Balaam said to God, I have prepared the 7 altars, and I have offered on each altar a bull and a ram. So he's trying to convince God that, hey, look, I'm worshiping you. I've just had built 7 altars and worshiped 7 and offered 7 bulls and 7 rams. God's not going to be impressed by that at all. Now let's talk about a couple of things before we move on. Again, this word 7. The number 7. That means completeness, as we've talked about, the way it's used in the Old Testament. Here's a comment from Zondervan Bible Backgrounds Commentary. A parallel use of 7 is found in a Babylonian text in which a worshiper is instructed to erect 7 altars before E, Shamash, and Marduk to set up 7 censers of Cyprus and then pour out as a libation offering the blood of 7 sheep. So again, it was typical in the Babylonian pagan world to have the number 7 involved in their worship. And also, a bull and a ram was involved in their worship. Here again from Zondervan, it says this. In ancient Near Eastern culture, the bull and the ram were the most prized of animals, and the sacrifices for persons of the upper echelon of society. For a divination context, this is a large offering reflecting the importance of the situation. A king acting on behalf of his people in an international crisis. Usually, a sacrifice performed in connection with divination was just one animal whose entrails were examined for an answer. Here, Balaam offers the sacrifices in order to induce Yahweh to deliver prophecy through him. So normally, they just offered one animal with the entrails, etc. But with the seven, they're hoping to get a word from God. He is. Okay, verse number 5. God is going to put a word in Balaam's mouth. Verse 5. Then the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, "Return to Balak, and thus you shall speak." So he returned to him, and there he was, standing by his burnt offering, he and all the princes of Moab. So God, we see here, puts words in Balaam's mouth to repeat to Balak. And when we start verse number 7 here, this is going to begin the first of 7 oracles of Balaam. And they all start with the words, "He took up his oracle and said." And whenever he prophesies or gives these oracles, instead of cursing Israel, he ends up blessing them. So God puts words in his mouth to speak to Balak, but they're going to be blessings and not curses. And there's going to be 7 of them altogether. Verse number 7. "And he took up his oracle and said, 'Balak, the king of Moab, has brought me from Aram, from the mountains of the east. Come, curse Jacob for me, and come, denounce Israel.'" Which, that's what he did. He had to come all that way to curse Israel. Verse number 8. "How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? And how shall I denounce whom the Lord has not denounced? From the top of the rocks I see him," you know, seeing Israel in their multitudes, "and from the hills I behold him. There, a people dwelling alone, not reckoning itself among the nations." Verse number 10, "Who can count the dust of Jacob or number 1/4 of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my end be like his. So these are words that God put in Balaam's mouth, and it's blessing. It's saying, how can I curse Israel? God has blessed them. Notice it says, "Who can count the dust of Jacob?" In other words, they are like the dust on the earth. You can't even number them. So Balak is hearing this from Balaam's mouth, and he's thinking, wait a minute, he's not cursing Israel at all. Verse number 11. "Then Balak said to Balaam, 'What have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, and look, you have blessed them bountifully.'" Verse 12. "So he answered, 'Must I not take heed to speak what the Lord has put in my mouth?' Then Balak said to him, 'Please come with me to another place from which you may see them. So you shall see only the outer part of them. You shall not see them all, and curse them for me from there.'" So he's going to take him to another high place of Baal, to take a look at not the huge numbers of them, to hope that he can curse them. Verse 14. "So he brought him to the field of Zophim, at the top of Pisgah," which is a huge mountain peak, "built 7 altars, offered a bull and a ram on each altar." Again, probably inspecting the livers, hoping that God would turn and give him what he wanted to say. So, looking here back at this term in verse number 14, where it says the field of Zophim, that actually means the field of the watchman. Zondervan says this, probably so named because of its strategic location. Several scholars interpret this location as a known place for observing heavenly omens and making astrological observations. So they'd go to this high peak of Pisgah, and they would look at the stars and the moon and try to determine, you know, the course of the gods, etc. The name Pisgah is one of the prominent mountain peaks in the region. This is actually where Moses views the promised land before he dies, and we'll come to that in Deuteronomy 34. And here, on this peak, in the field of Zophim, Balaam built 7 more altars, offered 7 more bulls and rams in a vain attempt to curse Israel. Verse 15. And he said to Balak, "Stand here by your burnt offering while I meet the Lord over there." So they made all these offerings. He's hoping for a good word from God. Verse 16. Then the Lord met Balaam, put a word in his mouth and said, "Go back to Balak, thus you shall speak." So God's going to put more words in Balaam's mouth, but it's not going to be cursings. Verse 17. So he came to him. There he was, standing by his burnt offering, and the princes of Moab were with him. And Balak said to him, "What has the Lord spoken?" So the same ritual of sacrifice had been done again. We see that God puts a word in Balaam's mouth. And Balaam returns to find Balak and his princes standing by the burnt offering. Then we come now to the second oracle of Balaam, words God puts into Balaam's mouth. Verse 18. Then he took up his oracle and said, "Rise up, Balak, and listen to me." Verse number 19. "God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. He has said, has he said, and will he not do? Or has he spoken, and will he not make good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot reverse it. He has not observed iniquity in Jacob, nor has he seen wickedness in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among him." So we see here that Balaam blesses Israel again, words that were put in God's mouth. Now, sometimes a question comes up about verse number 19 where it says, God's not a son of man that he should repent. That actually is better translated that he should change his mind. Zondervan adds this, "Unlike the gods of Mesopotamia, who were often whimsical and malleable, Israel's God was unchangeable and therefore of incomparable integrity." He wouldn't change his mind. He blesses Israel and doesn't curse them. Continuing on with this oracle from Balaam, words from God's, that God put into Balaam's mouth. Verse 22, "God brings them out of Egypt. Like he has strength like a wild ox." Verse 23, "There is no sorcery against Jacob, nor any divination against Israel. It now must be said of Jacob and of Israel, oh, what God has done." Verse 24, "Look, a people rises like a lioness, lifts itself up like a lion. It shall not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain." Okay, we see in this oracle the words God put into Balaam's mouth. We see a contrast here because the gods of the ancient Near East were often depicted as horned bulls or humans with the head of a bull, like Baal. Baal was depicted as a human with the head of a bull. But God is described by his power here like a wild ox, compared to a wild ox by his power. Okay, continuing on now, verse 25, and we're winding down. "Then Balak said to Balaam, 'Neither curse them at all, nor bless them at all.' So Balaam answered and said to Balak, 'Did I not tell you, saying, all that the Lord speaks, that I must do?' Then Balak said to him, 'Please come, I'll take you to another place. Perhaps it will please God that you may curse them for me from there.'" So he's going to take him yet to another place to curse Israel. Verse 28, "So Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor that overlooks the wasteland. Then Balaam said to Balak, 'Build for me 7 altars, prepare for me 7 bulls, 7 rams.' And Balak did as Balaam said, and he offered a bull and a ram on every altar." So they're going to go through the same pagan routine now, but this time on the top of Peor, which was another one of the peaks in the Abiram mountain range near the cultic site of Baal Peor. That brings us now to chapter 24, verse number 1. Now when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not go at other times to seek to use sorcery, but he set his face towards the wilderness. So Balaam decides sorcery is not going to work to curse Israel. He's going to take another plan of action. It says he set his face toward the wilderness. He realized that sorcery was futile. So instead he takes a look at all of the tribes in their order, and he's trying to devise another plan. Verse number 2. And Balaam raised his eyes, saw Israel encamped according to the tribes, and the Spirit of God came upon him. Now, let's take a look at this. Let's examine this further. We see the phrase, the Spirit of God came upon him. He received revelation in a different form. You know, previously, God had put words in Balaam's mouth. Now he most likely comes to him in some type of vision, in a visionary state. And it says that the Spirit of God came upon him. Now there's a difference between the Spirit coming upon individuals to give them insight and the Spirit dwelling within a person. When God's Spirit dwells within us, he works with us to walk in his ways. This Spirit coming upon him was to give him a certain vision. Now, we can look back, and we won't go there, but in 1 Samuel chapter 10, something happened similar to King Saul, where the Spirit of God came upon him, not to dwell in him, but to work with him in a certain way. Now, God is going did this for a certain reason, and that brings us to the third oracle of Balaam. In the previous oracles, Balaam had proclaimed God's relationship with Israel, and what God had done for Israel in the past. These oracles now, the ones we're going to read, include the vision of their settlement in Canaan, the rise of the monarchy, and the promises made to the patriarchs. So God's going to, through a vision, have him state these things. Verse number 3. Then he took up his oracle and said, the utterance of Balaam, the son of Beor, the utterance of the man whose eyes are opened, the utterance of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, who falls down with eyes wide open. Verse number 5, notice the blessings. How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel. Like valleys that stretch out, like gardens by the riverside, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. Verse 7, he shall pour water from his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Verse number 8, God brings him out of Egypt. He has strength like a wild ox. He shall consume the nations, his enemies. He shall break their bones and pierce them with arrows. So what God had brought upon Balaam here now is further blessings upon Israel. We see this term here in verse number 7, the name Agag. That was a name like a name among the Amalekites, like Pharaoh. And this oracle given by Balaam pictures future victories for Israel. Continuing on now with this oracle, verse number 9. He bows down. He lies down as a lion who shall rouse him. Blessed is he who blesses you, and cursed is he who curses you. Okay? Unwittingly, in this oracle, he repeats the promises made to Abraham. Remember Genesis chapter 12, verse number 3? God said to Abraham, leave your family, leave your land, and I will bless them. Blessed is he who blesses you, and cursed is he who curses you. Balaam unknowingly repeats this. Verse number 10. Then Balak, who's hearing all these blessings, Balak's anger was aroused against Balaam, and he struck his hands together. Now that's a sign of derision, that he's mad. And Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, and look, you have bountifully blessed them these 3 times. Now therefore, flee to your place. You know, go back home. I've had enough of you. I said I would greatly honor you, but in fact, the Lord has kept you back from your honor. So Balaam said to Balak, did I not also speak to your messengers who sent to me saying, if Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Lord to do good or bad of my own will. What the Lord says, that I must speak. So Balak sends Balaam away without paying him for his services. And Balaam tells him that no amount of money would change the will of God. Okay, that leads us to the fourth oracle by Balaam now. Words put in his mouth by God. Verse 14, and now indeed I am going to my people. Come, I will advise you what this people will do to your people in the latter days. Okay, now the latter days can refer to the distant future, but it also can refer to the end of the age ushered in by God. Verse 15, so he took up his oracle and said, the utterance of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the utterance of the man whose eyes are opened, the utterance of him who hears the words of God and has the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, who falls down with eyes wide open. Verse 17, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and batter the brow of Moab, and destroy all the sons of tumult. What he's doing now here is prophesying about the Messiah coming, and at the end of the age, he's going to put down all of the nations, which are described here as the sons of tumult. Verse 18, Edom shall be a possession, Seir also, his enemies, shall be a possession, while Israel does valiantly. Verse 19, out of Jacob, one shall have dominion and destroy the remains of the city. So, Balaam confirms God's promises to Abraham, and all of this was God's doing in the prophecy by Balaam. One more section here now that we have in closing. Balaam also prophesied the future of other peoples who had frequent contact with Israel, looking far into Israel's history and the ultimate domination by Rome. Again, words put in his mouth by God. Verse number 20, then he looked on Amalek, and he took up his oracle and said, Amalek was the first among the nations, but he shall be last until he perishes. Amalek was the first one that warred against Israel when they came out of Egypt. And he's saying they're going to perish. They were the first, but they will be the last until he perishes. Verse 21, then he looked on the Kenites, took up his oracle and said, firm is your dwelling place, and your nest is set in the rock. Nevertheless, Cain shall be burned, which was a tribe of the Kenites. How long until Asher, Assyria, carries you away captive? Then he took up his oracle and said, alas, who shall live when God does this? Remember, God controls the nations. That's basically what he's saying here. Verse 24, but ships shall come from the west, from the coast of Cyprus, talking about western Mediterranean powers like Rome, and they shall afflict Asher, Assyria, and afflict Eber, the Hebrews, and so shall Amalek until he perishes. So we're talking about the rise of Rome, the Roman powers, and destroying Assyria, the Hebrew controlling the Jews, the Hebrews, and Amalek, etc. And finally, verse 25. So Balaam rose, departed, and returned to his place, 300 miles away, and Balak also went his way, and they realized they could not curse Israel, that only they could be blessed. One more comment from the Nelson Study Bible. The general sense is clear enough. One nation would rise against another, only to face its doom. And the Hebrew word for Cyprus was used later in reference to Rome. And the point of all of this right here, this section right here, is from Balaam's mouth put there by God, is that God controls the nations. He controls history and the ultimate destiny of them all. So Balaam learned this pagan diviner a great lesson from the great God. That brings us to the end of chapter 24, but I'll leave you with some lessons like we usually do. First of all, Balak's whole intentions was to have Israel, God's people, cursed by a pagan diviner, Balaam. God, however, turned Balak's plans against him, and instead of cursing Israel, they were blessed by Balaam. Here's the lesson, and this is from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. It's very good. As the sovereign God, he rules and overrules in prophetic revelation as well as in all other areas of life. In other words, God is in control. Another lesson is that Balak builds 7 altars and sacrifices 7 bulls and 7 rams, you know, combining some of God's worship. And the lesson is that false religion often counterfeits elements of true worship of God in a superstitious and sometimes ritualistic way. And that's come down throughout the ages in the false religion. Okay, that's the end of this particular Bible study, unless anybody has any questions or comments.